Historian Douglas Brinkley described Theodore Roosevelt as a, quote, wilderness warrior president who conducted a conservation crusade for America. Roosevelt, as president, signed 5 new national parks into existence, created the first 18 national monuments by his new authority under the Antiquities Act. He created the first 51 federal bird reserves and 4 game preserves, and created or enlarged 150 national forests, in all placing over 230 million acres under federal protections. It would seem then appropriate that 6 different national park sites today honor Theodore Roosevelt. Today, we welcome Park Superintendent Valerie Naylor back on the podcast to talk about those parks. Hello, and welcome to the Talk About Teddy podcast, our weekly conversations exploring the world of Theodore Roosevelt. I'm your host, Kurt Skinner, and I'm joined as ever by my good friend and co-host, Larry Marple.
Today, we welcome back to the Talk About Teddy podcast our good friend and 31-year veteran of the National Park Service, Valerie Naylor. Welcome back, Valerie.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
Valerie, could you tell us about yourself for our listeners who may not have heard your visit with us in Episode 6?
I was a former superintendent of Theodore Roosevelt National Park, very proud that I spent so much time there. I'm the longest serving superintendent so far at 11 and a half years, and I also worked there starting as a volunteer in 1979 and for several seasons as a seasonal ranger, an employee of the Cooperating Association, and as a researcher. So I have a long history with Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
All right. Man, we're excited to have you back, yeah. Valerie. Well, as you know, we're going to call this episode Theodore Roosevelt, a Man of Many Parks. supposed to be a clever play on words there. But so when the presidents are rated by historians, TR is usually ranked up there in the top 5 with Washington, with Lincoln. You know, he respected both of those guys tremendously. I think he may not be crazy about his face being on Mount Rushmore, but I think he'd be pleased to share the space with those two at least. And you'd mentioned before that that Lincoln has 6 parks dedicated to him in the park system, as does TR, you know, which I'm certain that TR would be, you know, pleased with immensely there. Would you describe for our listeners those national parks that are dedicated to the memory of TR?
Sure. There are 6, at least the way I count them up and most people. And it's interesting because the first one set aside that helped to memorialize Theodore Roosevelt was Mount Rushmore. And that was set aside as a national memorial in 1925, even before the mountain was carved. And so, of course, he's up there with you. You mentioned Washington and Lincoln. You didn't mention Thomas Jefferson. I think there's probably a reason for that. But Gutzon Borglum, who carved Mount Rushmore, who was the sculptor, he had a lot to do with Theodore Roosevelt being up there on Mount Rushmore. He had a lot to do with developing the entire sculpture. But he had been a campaign person for Roosevelt, and he had met Roosevelt. So he had a special place in his heart for Theodore Roosevelt and ensured that he was there on Mount Rushmore with the other 3. The second one set aside in 1932 was Theodore Roosevelt Island in Washington, D.C. It's in the Potomac, and it's about 88 and a half acres. And it was overgrown farmland at one point, and then the Theodore Roosevelt Association acquired it and donated it to the federal government. The CCC worked out there. A forest was restored, and there's a statue of Theodore Roosevelt there. But really, the entire island is more or less a nature preserve that is a tribute to him. There's a lot of natural habitat there for wildlife, for birds, other wildlife. There's some forest land, marsh, swamp, of course, the river. There are hiking trails for recreation.
I think he would be delighted to have that as a memorial, it embodied the strenuous life, the love of nature, conservation, all of it.
And it's right there in Washington, D.C. Yeah. So it's a great place that a lot of people can reach easily.
Yes.
And a great place for them to spend time and see the kinds of things that inspired Theodore Roosevelt.
Of course, off the beaten track there in the Potomac.
Yeah. It is a little bit as far as getting there, but You can sure do it, and it's close into town. But Theodore Roosevelt National Park was the third one established. We talked about that in our previous podcast in 1947 in the North Dakota Badlands, of course. And that's the largest of the parks that are tributes to him at about 70,000 acres. And then Sagamore Hill National Historic Site, which of course was Theodore Roosevelt's home, was established as a National Historic Site in 1962 in Oyster Bay, Long Island. And it really is a place that tells the story of his life and his legacy, and especially his family. Mm-hmm. It's 83 acres and a place that he had visited and loved since he was a child, really, in the 1870s. And he lived there with Edith starting in, I think, about 1887. It was really the summer White House, the place where he raised his six children. And he died there.
Yeah.
In 1919. And in fact, Edith died there too in 1948. So yeah. It really is an excellent and beautiful memorial to Theodore Roosevelt and his family. The Theodore Roosevelt Association donated that in 1962. And that same year, they also donated the Theodore Roosevelt birthplace in New York City. And that was the home that he spent his first few years. That was donated by the TR Association. His grandfather bought it in 1850 and gave it to Theodore Roosevelt's parents as a wedding present. And Theodore Roosevelt was born in 1858. And then it wasn't until 1873 that the family moved from that location. Well, that house, as you probably know, was demolished, actually. Yeah. It was sold in 1873 and demolished. But then it was rebuilt, and because the one next door was the mirror image, they were able to rebuild it with accuracy. And so that was great. And so after TR's death in 1919, the family had bought it back and rebuilt it. And then it became a museum. And then in 1962, the TR Association donated it to the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. So then in 1971, the Theodore Roosevelt inaugural National Historic Site was opened, and that was on September 14th, exactly 70 years after he was inaugurated in the Wilcox Mansion in Buffalo. And that's when it was opened. And so Wilcox had this large house in Buffalo, and he was a man of the law. He was a conservationist and a reformer, much like Roosevelt, and he was a friend of TR. And when President McKinley was shot, and when he died, he was a guest in that house. And so that's where he was inaugurated in 1901. It's a very different park because it's not operated by the National Park Service, although it is a unit of the National Park System, but it's operated by the TR Inaugural Site Foundation, a nonprofit. Yeah. So it's a cooperative agreement between the National Park Service and the nonprofit that keeps that site open.
Yeah. Is that called a National Historic Site?
It is, yes.
Okay.
So it's definitely one of the national park units. It's just operated independently by a nonprofit.
Okay.
So you mentioned that there were also six parks that Abraham Lincoln could claim as commemorating him, and those are the Lincoln Memorial, dedicated in 1922 in Washington, D.C., Abraham Lincoln Birthplace in Kentucky, which was made a National Historic Site in 1916, the Lincoln Boyhood National Memorial in Indiana, Mount Rushmore, of course, which he shares with Theodore Roosevelt and others, the Lincoln Home in Springfield that became a national park in Illinois in 1971, and then Ford's Theater and the house where Lincoln died in Washington, D.C. So those are the six that are dedicated to Abraham Lincoln. So mm-hmm. It's rare for any one person to have any national park unit established to honor them, but it's particularly rare for any one person, even a president, to have six.
Yeah.
But TR and Lincoln both do.
I think TR would be pleased with that as well. I know he wrote to Bill Sewall in 1906 that, "I don't have to tell you that my great hero is Abraham Lincoln." So I can just see TR grinning and being delighted about that.
Yeah, I think aside from his father, probably there's no other man in history he admired more than Lincoln.
Yeah.
But he had an early introduction to Lincoln, didn't he? Didn't he watch the funeral procession when he was just a young boy?
Yeah, from his grandfather's house, Cornelius Van Schaack Roosevelt. He's watching it with his brother Elliot and little Edith Corot, who was a neighbor. But she starts crying since she's about 3 1/2, and he and Elliot don't want to be disturbed. They're young boys, about 5 1/2 TRs, and picks little Edith up, carries her out of the room, and locks the door. So,
and a romance was born.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, Valerie, I was wondering if we could follow up, since we're still talking about these six sites dedicated to TR. As I understand, you had a role when you were superintendent at TR National Park of acquiring a Centennial Challenge grant with the Park Service. Could you talk a little bit more about what that was about?
Yeah, the Centennial of the National Park Service being established was in 2016, and they put forth a Centennial Challenge type of grant program, and so the National Park Service could put in for money and then have a nonprofit partner or some other kind of partner contribute the same amount or more, and we could get things done. And so I put in two different projects during that time, and a lot of the superintendents I think were waiting for the following year, but I went ahead that first year and we were able to get money to digitize some of the collections for the Theodore Roosevelt Center in Dickinson, North Dakota, that were from Theodore Roosevelt National Park and those six parks dedicated to Theodore Roosevelt. They're not all finished yet, but Dickinson State put in a lot of money, way more than the National Park Service did. But it was a great start to that project of digitizing all of the papers and such from the six parks that were established to honor Theodore Roosevelt. And then there was another one that the park worked with Friends of the Elkhorn Ranch, which was a loose group of people that cared about the future of the Elkhorn and didn't want it to be destroyed by development surrounding it. And we were able to put in some exhibits and just a few small things that added to the ambiance of the Elkhorn Ranch without adding any development. And that was a really great partnership as well.
Yeah, that's just a cool story that you, as a superintendent of one of those parks, had a role in helping the TR Center, you know, get the funding and the initiative to find those gems, hopefully, that were still hidden away in some of the other TR sites for TR items. So that's we have all benefited from that that work. So thanks.
That's for sure. And also, it was a good opportunity to put in some interpretive exhibits in a very tasteful way at the Elkhorn Ranch, and some gates that fit the scenery so people didn't have to climb through barbed wire or around some uncomfortable cattle guard. So that worked very well too, working with Friends of the Elkhorn. So those were both really great projects, and I was very lucky to secure those and to have partners who were willing to donate an equal or much greater amount of money to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Kurt and I, in our historical portrayals of Theodore Roosevelt, we've discovered that there's many myths about TR and the national parks. Could you tell us what TR did and didn't do for the national parks?
Sure. I often hear people say, oh, Theodore Roosevelt, we love him. He gave us our first national parks, or he's responsible for the national parks. Or sometimes people will even say he's responsible for the National Park Service, or that he created Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, which he certainly didn't do. And so I don't want to burst their bubble, because Theodore Roosevelt did so much for the national parks, and he did so much for the national forests and so much for our national wildlife refuge system and conservation in general. But he certainly did not preserve Theodore Roosevelt National Park, because the idea for that came up much later. And I don't think TR would set aside a national park for himself at that time. But that one was established, as I mentioned, in 1947. He also did not create the first national park by any means. That was generally considered to be Yellowstone National Park, which was set aside by President Grant in 1872. Now, there are some disputes about that because it all depends on how you think about it, because Congress set aside Hot Springs Reservation in Arkansas back in 1832 as a place preserved for recreation, and that was the first time the federal government ever put aside anything like that, and it became a national park in 1921. And then Abraham Lincoln set aside Yosemite in 1864. Congress passed the legislation, but then that was given to California as a state park, and it didn't become a national park until 1890. So I have to give a little bit of time to those two parks that were sort of the original idea before we knew to call them national parks. Mm-hmm. But Yellowstone was the first one in 1872, and there were five at the time when Theodore Roosevelt took office. And interestingly, though, there were a couple of others that were established that were not any longer national parks at the time TR took office. But he doubled the size of the national park system, but it wasn't really a system then. There were just five parks, and he made it 10 parks during his time in office.
Mm-hmm.
So when he took office, the first five national parks were Yellowstone, Yosemite, Mount Rainier, Sequoia, and General Grant.
Yeah.
And General Grant was a very small national park near Sequoia, and its purpose was to protect what we call Grant's Grove in what is now Kings Canyon National Park that then encompassed that area. And so Sequoia and Kings Canyon are managed together because they're close by each other there. And did you know that at one time there was a proposal to call that Grant Grove area Roosevelt National Park?
It didn't go through
because we have another one now, so that's good.
But anyway. What time were they considering doing that, do you know?
At the same time when they were expanding and working on creating a national park around Grant's Grove.
Okay. Wow.
So when Sequoia and then Kings Canyon National Park was established. It was a discussion that did not pass Congress, so that never happened. So then Theodore Roosevelt was able to establish five national parks during his tenure.
So the five that that Roosevelt established, there was Crater Lake in 1902, right? Wind Cave in 1903, Soles Hill, 1904, Platte National Park, 1906, and right here in Colorado, Mesa Verde, 1906.
That's correct. So Theodore Roosevelt wanted to establish Crater Lake National Park. There was a lot of local support for that, and people wrote him letters and really pushed for that. And so that was the first of the national parks that he established. And the second was Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota. And that was the first one that was set aside that was a cave as any kind of a national park. And then there was Sully's Hill National Park in North Dakota. And that's one most people haven't heard of because it doesn't exist anymore. But that one has a long and convoluted story. And you could even say that it wasn't really a national park. It was national, and it was a park, and it was called a national park. But that is a story probably too long for today's broadcast. And then
we hope to get to that in the future.
Right, yeah. I hope so too. And then Platte National Park in Oklahoma was also a strange one with an unusual history. But that was an area that belonged to the Chickasaw and Choctaw people. And it was a spring and a very important one where they had to get their water. And they could see that development was happening all around them, and they thought that their access to the water would be cut off. And so they sold some land to the federal government, known as the Sulphur Springs Reservation, and that was to set aside that spring so they would have access. And then the name was changed a few years later to Platte National Park. And it was done so quickly, and it was just a signature. I don't think Theodore Roosevelt really had much to do with that. He just signed it. And in fact, the person that was acting as the superintendent of the Sulphur Springs Reservation, got a letter in the mail and said, from now on, it will be known as Platt National Park. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, I'll change the letterhead. And that was really all it was.
Wow.
To it. But it is still there, and it's quite an intriguing place. Platt National Park didn't have any of the usual things that you would think would be in a national park. And so the CCC went in there and built waterfalls and bridges and fountains and planted trees and shrubs and made it look more park-like. And it's a great little spot near Sulphur, Oklahoma. And it was later incorporated into Chickasaw National Recreation Area, which is there today. And so if you go to Chickasaw National Recreation Area, you will see Platt National Historic District. And it's beautiful. It's a great place to walk around, look at birds, enjoy mm-hmm. some water, stream. But it's not what you'd normally consider a national park. But it is still part of a national park unit.
I can't get over how many times you have referenced the CCC
yeah.
and how really we are still the benefactors of all that hard work put in the 1930s with the Civilian Conservation Corps in our park system.
Yeah,
they did an amazing job, especially considering the time period, because they did a lot of it by hand, things that would never be considered today to be done by hand.
Yeah.
And because of that, they've lasted, and they are not as intrusive on the landscape as many things that are built today.
Yeah.
The other national park that TR established, which I didn't mention, was Mesa Verde National Park, which was established in 1906. And that is important. You mentioned it was in Colorado. That was the first one set aside for its cultural resources, or to preserve the works yeah. of man, as they said. All the other national parks were set aside more for scenery or natural resources, as we'd call them today. But of course, Mesa Verde protects the archaeological sites that were built by the ancestral Pueblo people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a very special one and remains a national park today. So of the five national parks that Theodore Roosevelt established, three of them are still national parks.
Mm-hmm.
Crater Lake, Mesa Verde, and Wind Cave. Platt National Park is incorporated into Chickasaw National Recreation Area, and what was Sully's Hill National Park is now White Horse Hill National Game Preserve in North Dakota. So they all still exist under federal management, but they're not all exactly what they were at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You said Roosevelt was a child when Yellowstone was brought into existence as a park, but he does have a real role to play there, and it's with the Boone and Crockett Club with what became the 1894 Yellowstone Park Protection Act. You know, that's such an interesting TR tie-in there with the Boone and Crockett Club fighting to keep the Northern Pacific Railway from, you know, plowing through the middle of Yellowstone National Park. And I think by the early 1890s, you had in Yellowstone the last remaining wild bison herd in America. It was down to perhaps even just 100 head of bison, I think. But there was no penalties for poachers.
No.
And so, you know, the worst the park superintendent could do there was literally just confiscate their rifle and kick them out of the park, knowing that they'd be dealing with them again in a couple of weeks. And so poachers had almost decimated the game in our nation's first great national park.
Yeah.
So it took this new law to enact game protections and actual penalties, and it had much to do with TR and George Bird Grinnell
yeah.
with the
mm-hmm.
Boone and Crockett Club.
That's right, and that was important. There was a lot of stumbling around in the early days. I mean, we have your very first national park. Who manages it? How do you manage it?
Yeah.
What laws give you the authority to protect it and such? So that's true.
Well, I know on June 8th, 1906, TR signed the law, an Act for the Preservation of American Antiquities, which we know as the Antiquities Act. Can you tell us about the background of the act and what significance it had to the National Park Service?
Well, it was significant because it allowed a president to declare by public proclamation any historic landmark, historic and prehistoric structures, and other objects of historic and scientific interest for future generations. And Theodore Roosevelt signed that into existence. And then he proclaimed his very first national monument, Devil's Tower in Wyoming, in September of 1906. And I always think, what took him so long? You know, 3 months it took him to proclaim his first national monument. Maybe he was giving it a little bit of time to settle after the Antiquities Act was passed. And many national monuments have been established by presidents since. There's only been, I believe, three presidents that have not used the Antiquities Act at all.
Yeah, and the amount of acreage is left to the president's discretion in the Antiquities Act, right? I mean, it states that monuments are to be confined to, quote, the smallest area compatible with a proper care and management of the objects to be protected, end quote. You know, we see from some of his declarations that T.R.'s conception of small was clearly a lot bigger than most folks in D.C., you know, especially Congress, right?
I think the issue with that, though, in the past, it is not known as well as it is today of how much it takes to protect a specific area. And let me give you an example from my own career. I was superintendent of Scotts Bluff National Monument, which is in western Nebraska. It was proclaimed in 1918, and it has 3,000 acres, basically. And it's kind of a big square along the Platte River. And so the monument was set aside to protect the views of and from the bluff and the Oregon Trail that goes through that area, etc. But in those days, in 1918, the towns were far away, and 3,000 acres seemed like a lot just sitting out there in the prairie with a bluff in the middle of it. But now when you look at it, the towns have come up right to the boundary, and it's not very well protecting the views of and from the bluff or very much of the Oregon Trail or the prairie surrounding it, which is very important to that ecosystem. And that's because it just seemed unnecessary back in 1918 that needed to be bigger to protect that bluff. But now if you look at it, it would have been nice if it had been larger. That's not going to happen now, but it would have been a better park if it had been a little bit bigger. And so I think we have to look at it in that way. Now we know a lot more about ecosystems and wildlife and habitats and corridors and things that we need to preserve areas. And so the monuments tend to be larger now in many cases. Theodore Roosevelt proclaimed his first monument in September of 1906. Of course, he only had about 2+ years more in office. So later in 1906, in December, he proclaimed El Morro in New Mexico, Montezuma Castle in Arizona, Petrified Forest in Arizona. And then in 1907, he proclaimed Chaco Canyon National Monument, Lassen Peak and Cinder Cone National Monuments in California, Tonto National Monument in Arizona, and Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument in New Mexico. So there were five. And then in 1908, he did Muir Woods in California in the Bay Area, Grand Canyon, because Congress wouldn't make it a national park, so he proclaimed Grand Canyon National Monument, Pinnacles National Monument in California, Jewel Cave National Monument in South Dakota, Natural Bridges in Utah, Lewis and Clark Caverns in Montana, Tumacockery in Arizona, and Wheeler National Monument in Colorado. And then just a few days before he left office, he proclaimed Mount Olympus National Monument in Washington. And some of those are national parks today, or have different names besides national monuments. But all but one are still under federal care and federal management. So there is a long history of establishing a large national monument to protect someplace that's spectacular and special from special interests. And that continues today as well. Of those national monuments that Theodore Roosevelt established, many of them still are national monuments. Petrified Forest is now Petrified Forest National Park. I had the good pleasure of working there for a short time. Lassen Peak and Cindercone National Monuments in California are consolidated into Lassen Volcanic National Park, which is spectacular in the California mountains. Chaco Canyon National Monument is now Chaco Culture National Historical Park. Grand Canyon, as we mentioned, is a national park. Pinnacles is a national park. And Mount Olympus is now part of Olympic National Park in Washington State.
So I think some of our listeners might be attuned to this, but can you maybe just explain the distinction then if the Antiquities Act gives the president the authority to unilaterally declare by executive authority a national monument, what then is required for a national park to be established?
It takes an act of Congress to establish a national park. So as a friend of mine used to say in her interpretive program, for a national monument, you only had to convince one person. For a national park, you had to convince hundreds of people, and the president had to sign it. And so it's much more complicated to establish a national park. However, many monuments, including the Grand Canyon, as we mentioned, are now national parks and have had that act of Congress to establish them as such.
As far as the redesignated parks under TR, you talked about Solis Hill and Platte. What has become of a couple of those monuments, Wheeler and Lewis and Clark?
Lewis and Clark Caverns was a national monument. They set it aside. They had rangers from Yellowstone, which is a fair distance, especially in those days, go up there and check on it once in a while to make sure it was okay. But it wasn't really managed because they were waiting for funding, and they didn't have funding to do anything with it as a national monument. And there was a man named Morrison who was one of the first ones to really explore those caves along with some others, and he wanted to make a commercial enterprise out of it, and he asked the Park Service, and they said no. So he did it anyway, and he would lead tours of the caves, let people take little pieces home with them and such. He had staff, he hired tour guides, all these things. And the Park Service would go up once or twice a year and change the lock on the gate and tell him to knock it off. And then as soon as they left, he'd go back and do it again. And then they'd go up again and change the lock on the gate. And so it was a long time, and there was still no funding for that. And Montana had created a state park system, but there were no parks. And so they thought this would make a great first state park for Montana, and it was. And so the federal government ceded that to Montana as a state park, and it is run very well. They do a great job. It might be my favorite cave park anywhere. Mm. It's kind of a difficult one to get to. You have to climb up a hill and then go through, and there's a little ladder or like a little chute you have to slide down inside and all of that.
Wow.
But they do a great job of preserving it. They do a lot with interpretation of the protection, the importance of protection of the cave and the bats and all of that. And so I love going there. It's named Lewis and Clark because Lewis and Clark went by it, but they never saw it. And really, it was thought that the Native Americans never really went in there either. It wasn't until later. It was very well hidden in the day.
Mm. Yeah, it's pretty near the Three Forks area,
right,
there in mm-hmm. Montana, where they had to make the decision which course they were going to proceed up.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful
pretty
park,
area.
And in my opinion, Montana does an excellent job of managing that.
Yeah.
The other one is really interesting, too, is Wheeler National Monument in Colorado. TR proclaimed that one, and it is near Creed, Colorado. And people did visit it. They would take horses and wagons in there in the early days after it was proclaimed. But once the highways started going through, people weren't as interested in doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. They weren't really interested in taking horses and wagons when they could take the highway. And so it became pretty isolated. And so today it's reverted back to Forest Service management. It's part of the Rio Grande National Forest and the La Garita Wilderness Area. And it's a special geologic area within a wilderness, within a national forest. So it has great protection, and it's very hard to get there. It's a 14-mile rough road to get there. And you can't get all the way to the former monument by road, but you can get sort of close, and it takes a pretty good kind of a 4x4 side-by-side to get there. That road has the deepest ruts that I have ever seen in my life.
Wow.
And you can hike there as well. It's difficult, not so much because of the terrain, but because it's at 11,000 feet. Hmm. And so unless you're acclimated to that, it takes some pretty heavy breathing to get to
Well, Larry doesn't know this, but when he comes out to visit me in Colorado, we're taking a field trip there and we're hiking to the top.
Bully.
All right.
Great. Well, I did take a little expedition there a few years ago with four close friends of mine. There were five of us, and we did rent a UTV, and we mm-hmm. went up the road and then hiked into the area, and it is absolutely amazing and fascinating. But I think, again, the Forest Service is doing a great job of preserving it there in the wilderness. Good.
I think TR was shown some photographs of that area, and I can't help but think it reminded him somewhat of the Badlands of North Dakota.
Possibly. It's a very different formation in a lot of ways, but of course erosion plays a role, so it has some similarities. And it's beautiful. It's fascinating. And it's a good hike, too. It's pretty good exercise getting into there.
Well, we're excited. You've agreed to be the National Parks Vagabond Tour Guide to explore with our listeners on the Talk About Teddy podcast the 23 parks that TR designated during his presidency. So could you tell our listeners how you plan to organize the podcast tours?
Well, I think we should organize them by region mm-hmm. and look at the different parks that he established. As you know, I do work very part-time for the Theodore Roosevelt Center in Dickinson, North Dakota, at Dickinson State University. And so the job that I've had for them for the last few years is going around to these various national parks and monuments that Theodore Roosevelt established and seeing what's in their collections that would be of interest to the Theodore Roosevelt Center. And some of the parks have a lot of material. Some of it is really funny and interesting, and some of it is rather mundane and kind of governmental, but some of them don't have anything either. But it's still a great opportunity to go to these parks and see what they might have, and it's something that I do when I travel anyway, which I do most of the time, and that's where I get the National Park Vagabond moniker. My official title with the Theodore Roosevelt Center is National Parks Researcher. So I think it would make sense that we could talk about the national parks that Theodore Roosevelt established on the West Coast in Washington, Oregon, and California.
Yeah.
The parks and mm-hmm. monuments. We could talk about those that he established in the desert Southwest, in Arizona and New Mexico, and then in the Rocky Mountains, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah.
Yeah.
And then the parks in the Great Plains, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. In this case, and that would be a nice way to organize those, to discuss them and why he did that. He didn't establish any national parks or monuments in the eastern U.S. They were all in the west.
Yeah, a lot of that land was pretty much spoken for east of the Mississippi, wasn't it?
Well, that's true, although there are new national monuments there a lot now in various places. Mm-hmm. Recognizing other parts of our history. And that's a really great thing about the national park system, is that there are no more Yellowstones out there.
No.
But there are many places that are significant scientifically and also places that are very important to our history as a people in the U.S. And those are still being added as national monuments to recognize that. Some of it are more recent history, say in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And what do you say that number is at now for the total number of parks in the system?
It should be 426 right now.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So our next episode, where we're going to have you on, then we're talking about the Pacific states, Washington, Oregon, California. So that would take in
Mount Olympus in Washington, Crater Lake National Park in Oregon, Lassen Peak and Cinder Cone National Monuments, which is now Lassen Volcanic National Park in California, Muir Woods, Pinnacles in California. And we could also talk a little bit about Theodore Roosevelt's things he said about Redwood and his visit to the Presidio, which is part of Golden Gate National Park. So there are other things to talk about there too, but that could be our next podcast.
That will be great. Well, Valerie, once again, we have loved having this conversation about the park system and talking about TR, a man of many parks. And we are looking forward to the next time that we can get together and about the Pacific parks and monuments associated with Theodore Roosevelt. So thank you so much for being on again.
Thank you, too. I really appreciate it. It's always great to talk about national parks, and it's always great to talk about Theodore Roosevelt. And one of my favorite topics is combining the two together.
Good. Well, we've thoroughly enjoyed it.
We've had some great feedback already from your first episode, and I suspect that's going to keep up. So if you love Valerie Naylor, keep tuning in.
Yes.
Thank you.
We want to thank each of you for listening. We would love to do an episode directed by you, our listeners.
So please send any questions that you might have on Theodore Roosevelt, and we'll do our best to share the answers on an upcoming episode.
You can email us your questions at talkaboutteddypodcast@gmail.com. And you can also submit your questions on our contact page on our website, talkaboutteddy.com.
And we look forward to your bully questions. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening.
You can find this podcast on our website, talkaboutteddy.com, where you can see show notes and transcripts, links to resources, and additional TR content. And please tell us what you think.
If you've enjoyed our content, please consider subscribing and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, and tell your friends and family about us, because it really does make a tremendous difference and it helps others find this show.
We hope you'll join us for the next episode of Talk About Teddy. And until then, as our friend Colonel Roosevelt would say,
do what you can with what you have, where you are.
Bullet.